You're listening to the History of Religions and Their Gods, hosted by yours truly, the skeptical ghost heathen. I don't know if you're going to find this at the local Jiffy Pop, but you're definitely going to want some salmon lox and bagels for this one, baby. Heathens and history buffs, welcome back to the big little show, The History of Religions and Their Goddesses. That's right. See what I did there? Goddesses. Because this episode, in fact, is entitled The Queen of Heaven. Now, I hope that you are enjoying the new season so far. Are you? Are you guys paying attention? Is it too much? Might need to listen to each episode a couple of times. I know I do. But we're trying to discover who the creator of the entire universe is, Yahweh. Where did his name come from? Why did he introduce himself to the patriarchs as other names that all contain the theophoric element of El in it, such as El, Elohim, and El Shaddai? Why do we have the engravings from Shechem near Jerusalem where El Barith, who is the god of the covenant, and Baal Barith, lord of the covenant, were being worshipped there? Also, what about that list of Shaddai gods? Names that seem to represent a series of gods under the Shaddai name. Well, today we're going to explore and we're going to break it down, everything that we know about that relationship between Yahweh, the storm god, and Asherah, the queen of heaven. And perhaps their connections to the name El, the main Canaanite god, and the Shaddai gods of Shechem. We will also start to look closer at that relationship between Abraham and his wife Sarah, and this covenant with the Lord, or perhaps a king of nations, moving forward. So if you're ready to do this thing, guys, well, let's hop into our time buggy machines, and let's go find some Shaddai gods. Because, folks, if it isn't funny, if it's not blasphemous and educational, then why bother? Just as we have very little evidence for El as a separate Israelite deity from Yahweh, especially during the period of the Judges being 1200 to 1000 BCE, well, the same goes, unfortunately, for our Queen of Heaven, Asherah, as she too is poorly mentioned as a separate Israelite goddess in this same time period. The only arguments for the Asherah as a goddess in this time period rest in the Book of Judges in chapter 6, and elsewhere, where she is mentioned alongside with Baal, who can once again represent a deity or a human, taking on the role of a great leader or royalty. So this means that Asherah may have also been a human too, who, like Baal, that carried lord-like features, roles, and responsibilities, and could have come from a royal family or priesthood. But the stories found in Judges 6, they seem to focus way more attention on the worship of Baal, whether human lord or deity, and really not much else for Asherah, because it's only the symbol of the Asherah that bears the name of the goddess that is criticized by those authors who are trying to depict Israelite worship sometime between 1150 and 1025 BCE. Of course, while writing centuries after the fact. Furthermore, unlike El and Baal, well, Asherah, she does not appear as the theophoric element as seen in the Hebrew names, meaning whoever she was not labeled as divine, with a cult that was built up around her. Now, in recent years, it has been claimed that the Asherah was, in fact, an Israelite goddess, as well as consort or wife of Yahweh. Because her name, or at least the cultic item that symbolized her as the Asherah, appears in an 8th century BCE inscription from the Kentulit Adjerud, as well as the Kirbet Elquam. And in these inscriptions, they refer to the symbol that was originally named after the goddess. Although during the 8th century BCE, it would no longer have symbolized the goddess in that way any longer. However, this conclusion does not address the issue of whether Asherah was distinguished as a separate goddess and consort of Yahweh in the period of the Judges, being 1200 to 1000 BCE. Now, for whatever reason, the author writing after the exile, some 3 centuries removed, believe that to be the case. Now, it can be argued that the symbol was created for her, probably after her death, was in fact part of the cult of Yahweh in this period. But whoever this mystery woman was, and whatever her relationship was with this Yahweh, the human manifestation of El, that is, was venerated after her death. But more than likely, the Yahwistic priesthood refused to deify her, and leaving her symbol open for condemnation in later centuries by biblical poets. Now, many scholars believe that Israelites loved her, whether in her divine status as a goddess or in her human manifestation even after Yahweh's passing and his deification. Now, this might also explain why so much misogyny is present in the Old Testament, because this most definitely would have been during the push for monotheism after the exile in 537 BCE. Now, just as El and Baal and all of their imagery were adopted to the cult of Yahweh by the priesthood who were operating the temple cult at the time, Asherah too, the Lord's consort, was a symbol in the cult of Yahweh during this time period as well. Now, there is one particular passage that we have to look at that might just point to Asherah as an Israelite goddess at some point in Israel's early history. Because in Genesis chapter 49, reports Jacob's blessings to his 12 sons. And many scholars argue that verses 24 to 26, which are part of the blessings to Joseph, represent a series of divine epithets, including 2 titles for Asherah. Now here's the translation.
His bow stayed taut, his hands were agile. By the bull of Jacob, by the strength of the shepherd, the stone of Israel, by El, your father who helps you, by Shaddai, who blesses you, with the blessings from heaven, from above, the blessings of the deep, crouching below, the blessings of the breast and womb, the blessings of your father, hero and almighty, the blessings of the eternal mountains, the delight of the everlasting hills. May thee be on the head of Joseph, on the crown of the chosen brothers.
So within verses 24 to 26 here, we have 4 sets of divine epithets. Number 1, we have Bull of Jacob, Shepherd and Stone of Israel. Then number 2, El, your father who saves you, and Shaddai, who blesses you. Number 3, heaven above, and deep crouching below. And number 4, breast and womb, and your father, hero, and almighty. Now, most of these epithets, including father and Shaddai, are attributed elsewhere to Yahweh and El, such as Bull of Jacob. It's also a title given to Yahweh in Psalms 132, verses 2 through 5. As well as Isaiah 49:26 and 60:16. Also, the pair of heaven and deep is described in a similar fashion in Deuteronomy 33:13. Now there, the word do, D-E-W, occurs in the same syntactic position as above, as seen in Genesis 49:25. And in Genesis 27:39, it combines differently the various terms associated with heaven in these verses. Now, for example, from the dew of heaven above. Now, some scholars understand that verse 26 to be a series of epithets and translations. It translates to, the blessings of your Father, Hero and Almighty, and with divine epithets connected to it. Then verse 25 also contains divine epithets of blessings of breasts and womb. A divine epithet of blessings of breast and womb. Now, so with this reading of this verse, it's compelling to scholars, is it not? It should be compelling to you and me right now where you're sitting in your cars. And me in my studio. Because given the pairs of epithets in the preceding lines, that they are indeed of divine nature, and associated with breast and womb, who could be and should be referring to Yahweh's consort, Asherah, or perhaps Sarah. Now, indeed, the titles of verse 25 are paired with the title of your father of verse 26, which also recalls a standard divine El epithet. Now the phrase, Sadeum Waraham, in verse 25. Well, it seems to echo Ugaritic titles for the goddess Asherah, as well as Anat. In fact, there is a word that is associated with the goddess Anat in ancient Ugaritic texts. And this title refers to her pairing with Asherah. In an invocation or a petition through prayer, found in these inscriptions, the beautiful gods. These beautiful gods are characterized as receiving nourishment from both Asherah and Anat, and it reads like this. I would invoke the beautiful gods, voracious ones of the sea, sons of the sea, who suck from the teat of the breast of Asherah and Rame. Now, the description that we get of these beautiful gods is also paralleled in other Ugaritic inscriptions as well, which refer to a goddess with the word lady, a lady goddess. Now, perhaps this is a title for Anat or Asherah in their divine yet human state. Because in Genesis 49, verses 25 to 26, the breast and womb might be a title that is attributed to a goddess, paired with the male imagery of El as father. El being the divine manifestation of whoever this king or prince might have been with the epithet YHWH, Yahweh, which I believe is a truncated form of a much larger title. This pair would belong to a larger sequence of paired epithets, which would also include divine titles for El. Now, the question of which goddess might be involved shouldn't be too difficult to figure out, because the epithets simply do not belong to Anat, because her cult is never mentioned in Iron Age Israel or Phoenicia in either a positive or a negative light. However, I guess we could consider Astarte as the goddess mentioned in Genesis 49:25. Simply because her name is associated with natural fertility, which is the setting for the entire epithet found in this passage. But more specifically, the expression Astarat Soin. It refers to the youth of animals as seen in Deuteronomy 7:13, 28:4, 18 and 51, and it derives from the goddess's name in concept with the word Soin, which is a collective term for small animals such as sheep and goats. Additionally, there are later references to Astarte found in biblical literature such as Judges 2:13 and 10:6. But the strongest evidence that we have actually supports Asherah as the goddess who is evoked by the female epithets in Genesis 49:25. Now, the Ugaritic background of these epithets seem to really favor Asherah for the goddess mentioned in Genesis 49:25. Because the pairing of Sadim Waraham with El would further point us in that direction of Asherah, since Asherah is the goddess, the same goddess paired with El in the Ugaritic text. So why would you assume anything different? However, other interpretations are possible, I suppose, for Sadim Waraham. These terms meaning breast and womb could be interpreted in purely natural terms, simply as a sign of natural fertility. And it is this interpretation that represents the traditional view of the term and is reflected in most modern translations of the Bible, such as RSV and NAB, etc. But the word Sadim could be translated differently and understood to refer to mountains, similar with the Akkadian word Sadu. And Raham could also be understood as winds, the plural of Ruah in Hebrew. So the first alternative would fit much better with the settings of fertility in these verses. Then the second alternative would comport with cosmic terms, heaven and deeps in the preceding lines, and eternal mountains and everlasting hills in the following line. But the pairing with El and Asherah favors the interpretation of Sadim Waraham as the epithet for Asherah. So if this interpretation is correct of Genesis 49:25, then El and Asherah were recognized as Israelite deities, distinguished separately from Yahweh, who seemingly is invoked separately on his own in verse 18. Now, this chapter of Genesis might then represent a tradition of an early stage in Israel's religious history in which El and Yahweh were not necessarily identified as one being yet. And Asherah stood as an identifiable goddess on her own. As we discussed in the last episode, in Ugaritic literature, El was the divine manifestation of the Lord Baal. Baal simply meaning Lord, Master, and sometimes Husband. Now, we also saw this in Egyptian inscriptions as well, such as with King Merneptah, where the god or the goddesses acted as extensions and witnesses to the king's worldly authority. At least in this interpretation, Asherah would be considered divine, but I believe only as an extension to her relationship with her consort Yahweh, as he takes on the status, roles, and attributes of the Canaanite supreme god El. Now, this would mean that Yahweh was a king or a ruler who took on the role of El. So that leaves us with the question, who was this Asherah and Yahweh before becoming deified? Temporarily for Asherah, anyway. And how did they conquer the world? Now, in subsequent traditions, the titles of El in this passage were treated differently from Sadim Waraham. Because in the period of the monarchy, sometime close to around 1,900 BCE, well, the masculine titles for El as well as Baal were both regarded as epithets for Yahweh, as their attestations in Deuteronomy 33:26-27, as well as Psalms 18 show. And the female imagery found in Genesis 49:25 suffered a different fate in the history of tradition. Because Asherah, she was not directly assimilated to Yahweh in the way that the masculine epithets were. Rather, these epithets were not applied to Yahweh at all. And these, as we discussed previously, the female language for the divine appears infrequently as well as indirectly in biblical texts. Ultimately, in the history of this interpretation of Genesis 49-25, it also illustrates the way that this female language was treated overall by men. In fact, modern translations today and commentaries generally treat the language of breast and womb in purely natural terms, despite the cluster of divine epithets that's surrounding this phrase. It's like even modern men today analyzing this phrase simply do not want to elevate Asherah to divine status. Instead, just assuming that the text meant that God would provide natural, nurturing, assuming that he too had breasts, I guess, as well as a womb. Now, the author Olean, in his book, Asherah and the Cult of Yahweh, demonstrated that Asherah was a goddess who was paired alongside with El. And this pairing was given to Israelite religion by virtue of the Yahweh-El identification. Now, this reconstruction is consistent with the evidence of Genesis 49:25. However, the subsequent history of the language for the female seems to differ a little bit. Because in some quarters, devotion to the goddess may have persisted. But neither biblical information nor any inscriptional material unambiguously confirms this historical reconstruction for us. Instead, the explicit cult of the goddess simply may not have endured. Like I said earlier, especially after her death, when the cults may have been built up around her, only to be later destroyed by the priesthood of the Yahweh cult. Now, the maternal language that was originally used for the goddess and then was made cultically present through later symbols of the Asherah, where she's basically represented by a pole or a stick or an idol, as seen in the king's narrative, seemingly was eliminated altogether at a later point in the cult of Yahweh. And the title and imagery belonging to El and Baal in Genesis 49:24, well, it raises a further question about the nature of conflation of deities in early Israel. Because while later tradition presumed that these verses were describing Yahweh, but the God treated in these verses certainly seems to be a different God entirely, since Yahweh is invoked in a whole separate verse on his own, verse 18. It's verse 18 before we are introduced to all these other deities, including the probability of Asherah. Now, another important piece of evidence that we should look at is a cultic stand from the site of Tanakh, and it points to Israelite devotion to Asherah sometime in early monarchy, dated somewhere around 1000 to 9000 BCE by archaeologists and excavators. But this square hollow stand has four levels or registers that are each depicting a divine symbol. Now, at the bottom of the level of this thing, it depicts a naked female figure with each of her hands resting on the heads of lions, or perhaps lionesses, and they're basically flanking her from each side. Now, this figure could be the Anat, or Asherah, or even Astarte. But the attestation of Astarte's cult during this period, along with her iconography with the lion in Egypt, might actually favor the identification of the female figure that's standing with her. Because the second lowest level or register has an opening in the middle, flanked by two sphinxes, with a lion's body, bird's wings, and a female human head. Then on the next register, it has a sacred tree, composed of a heavy central trunk that's sprouting symmetrically, three pairs of curling branches. Then we have two ibexes, or wild goats, with long curling horns that are standing on their hind legs, and both are facing the tree in the center. And on the outside of the two ibexes are two lions. So clearly the symbol of the tree is an Asherah named after the goddess Asherah, who the author for Hosea 2:16 will condemn those who worship her. And at the top register, there is a depiction of a young four-legged animal, either a bovine such as an ox, or perhaps a young bull without horns. Now, this animal, being a bull, represented either Baal or Yahweh in the 10th century Tanakh, because the Yahwistic priesthood hadn't yet begun destroying the temples and the altars to Baal yet. Not for at least another 100 years, anyway. Then finally, above the bovine, appears a solar disk, the symbol of the sun deity that appears with the most major gods in iconography of this period. And in short, assuming the correct dating of the stand to the 10th century or 9th century BCE, then the stand would confirm that polytheism was practiced in this area. So the Tanakh stand suggests that from 1000 to 587 BCE, the city maintained the worship of a god there, either Yahweh or Baal, a goddess, probably Astarte, and with the devotion to the goddess Asherah. So the significance of the Tanakh stand for understanding Israelite religion during the early years of the monarchy, of course, hinges in part on the accuracy of the dating of the stand by its archaeologists and excavators, although most scholars are confident in its dating. But if the stand is indeed dated correctly, then it will constitute enough evidence for the acceptance of polytheism in early Israelite tradition prior to the development of the cult of Yahweh and monotheism. Even in the book of Judges, chapter 1, verse 27, it suggests that the city remained at least partially Canaanite down to the period of the monarchy, 1150 to 1000 BCE. And then afterwards, following the rise of the Davidic dynasty, the city would then become Israelite and abandon some Canaanite traditions. In fact, in Solomon's organization of the nation, it lists Tanakh and Megiddo in the fifth districts as seen in 1 Kings 4:12. Though politically identified as Israelite, the city did continue on with its cultic Canaanite traditions, which flourished in the valleys and the coastal cities in the late Bronze Age. So again, if dated to the early monarchy, the Tanakh stand would appear to provide us with enough evidence for the existence of Israelite polytheism that included a devotion to Asherah, the goddess, and is continuous with earlier Canaanite traditions. Now, it seems clear that Anat was not a goddess during Iron Age Israel. Apart from some proper names, the evidence for her cult is virtually non-existent, so it kind of rules her out a little bit. As we discussed in previous episodes, her imagery and iconography also became part of the repertoire for Yahweh. There was also solar worship in this early period that likewise is difficult to establish. However, solar imagery for Yahweh did begin to develop during the period of the monarchy, sometime after 1000 BCE, perhaps through the influence of monarchic religious ideologies. Now, when trying to pinpoint the geographical distribution of all these deities, well, it's not that easy, guys. But what we can see evidence of is that the cult of Yahweh, along with the symbol of Asherah, the Queen of Heaven, appears from later data to be general features of both the northern and southern religions, or northern and southern kingdoms, if you would. Now, the northern evidence for the Canaanite god El, it seems clear to us from the cult that we saw to him in Shechem as El-Berit, the god of the covenant, along with Baal-Berit as his local human manifestation, Lord, Master, or Husband of the Covenant. Jerusalem, too, probably represents another cultic site where the royal cult of Yahweh assumed the indigenous traditions of El. Also, the monarchic solar imagery for Yahweh seems to be strictly a southern development, which was a specific feature of the royal Judean cult. And the information that we have about Baal, it stems largely from northern sources, but he was apparently popular in both the northern as well as the southern kingdoms. And evidence for Astarte is extremely rare in the period of the Judges, 1200 to 1000 BCE. And then lastly, the biblical evidence may stem from a later southern polemic against this goddess. Now, guys, the story continues on. Because I don't know if you remember or not, if you saw it in the news, but about a century ago, maybe you were there, maybe you weren't, there's a farmer who was plowing his field in northwest Syria, and serendipitously, or we'll say accidentally, stumbled upon an ancient tomb. Holy shit, right? And this discovery led to the excavation of two temples, and two libraries, and one palace, and several dwellings of the ancient city of Ugarit. Now, the gateway between the Mediterranean basin and Mesopotamia. Ugarit was a major capital that reached its pinnacle during the late Bronze Age and, get this, under the control of the Amorites. That's right, the one that the Bible authors hated. Well, at least the God of the Bible instructed the Israelites to kill the Amorites. But also numerous clay tablets dating from right around 1450 to 1180 BCE during the period of the Judges were found during this excavation and have taught us a great deal about the Canaanite religion of this time. Now, in many of these Ugaritic texts, they describe rituals and some offerings and myths that reveal several parallels found within passages of the Hebrew Bible. No, I can't believe it. But they also describe the activities of the main gods and goddesses of the Canaanite pantheon. Such as in this universe, the god El, who is ruling in tandem with his son, the warrior god Baal, and his wife, Atherat. Known in the Bible, of course, as Asherah, or perhaps the human, Sarah, who is married to Abraham, if you would. And together they rule supreme over a council of other deities, or generals, made of a lower level of attendant gods. In total, a list exceeding 200 deities are recorded in the Ugarit pantheon. And among the main opposing forces, we find Yam, the god of the sea, and Mot, the god of death, and Resheph, the burning god of the underworld, and Deber, a somewhat more obscure deity associated with the plague. Now, many biblical scholars have not yet taken the full measure of the role played by these texts on the production of Israelite literature, perhaps because the protagonists are different, because the stories differ from those of the Bible ever so slightly. However, their main impact is undeniable, especially in the older poetic literature, such as in Psalms and the Habakkuk. We'll start with the Habakkuk 3:3. Where Eloah, or God, came from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran, Salah. His glory covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. Habakkuk 3:4, and his brightness was as the light. He had horns coming out of his hands, and there was the hiding of his power. Habakkuk 3:5, before him went the pestilence, identified by Deber, and burning coals, Resheph, went forth at his feet. And then in Psalms 82, Elohim is portrayed as the supreme authority, ruling all over all other gods. And this passage is often cited as evidence for the influence of Ugaritic polytheism in the Hebrew Bible. Now let's take a look at some of these. In Psalms 82:1, Elohim, which is historically standard for multiple gods, standeth in the congregation of the mighty El. He judgeth among the gods. Again, using the term Elohim. Psalms 82:6, I have said, ye are gods, using the word Elohim, and all of you are children of the Most High, using the word Elyon. Then 82:7, but ye shall die like men and fall like one of the princes. Now that's very interesting, right? Because now we also brought a human nature into the situation with the gods. Now the author Mark Smith, well, he comments on the figure of God in Psalms 82 as this. Here the figure of God, understood as Yahweh, takes a stand in the assembly of other gods, And the name El was understood in the tradition, and perhaps at the time of the text's original composition as well, to be none other than Yahweh and not a separate god called El. In any case, the assembly consists of all the gods of the world, for all these other gods are condemned to death in verse 6. Now, this notion of gods that shall die like men applies well to the idea of the cult of the dead kin, of kings and gods dying like a man, but surviving forever as a god. It is also worth noting that the concept of divine assembly was still present in 1 Kings 22, which suggests this concept was deeply rooted in tradition. Now, Kings 22:19 reads, "And he said, Hear thou, therefore, the word of the Lord," presuming Yahweh. "I saw the Lord, Yahweh, sitting on his throne, and all the hosts of heaven standing by him on his right hand and on his left." Now, Smith stresses the significance and importance that existed between the Ugaritic and biblical literature and the continuum that it offers with Yahweh. And Mark says this, "The literary and religious features shared by the Ugaritic text and the Bible include not simply vague parallels, but cultural specifics. For example, the religion headed by El and his divine family, as known at Ugaritic as perceptible in a number of relatively early Israelite sources, was historically superseded by the god that emerged as Israel's national divine patron, Yahweh." And then Smith also criticizes biblical scholars for not paying enough attention to the contribution of Ugaritic literature in comparison to the Bible. And he says this, "In recent years, some scholars have shown a marked disinclination to use Ugaritic text in order to study the background of Israelite religion and literature. This question is raised because biblical scholarship, more broadly, has not fully absorbed the gains produced in the field. With these more recent studies that devalue the use of Ugaritic, the field runs the risk of ignoring the larger contribution that the study of Ugaritic makes to the understanding of the Bible." Now, for sure, guys, this contribution, it runs way deeper than previously suspected, and way deeper than what scholars suspected, as our investigation is demonstrating in just the last 3 episodes. Because in the Babylonian story of the Enuma Elise, told centuries, if not half a millennia, before the Yahweh story, well, Marduk also appears as presiding over a divine council of his own. However, when comparing the Ugaritic and Mesopotamian conceptions of divinities, well, again, Mark Smith stresses the importance of the household family model that characterizes the Ugaritic pantheon. I want to say that again. It stresses the importance of the household family model that characterizes the Ugaritic pantheon. And Mark Smith quotes, "On the whole, Mesopotamia does not use the divine household as a means of achieving conceptual unity to the same extent as Ugaritic myths. In general, it is my impression that the root metaphor of the family, although well attested for specific relationships between deities, does not extend as strongly to the collectivity of divinities in Mesopotamia." So, this unique aspect of the Ugaritic pantheon proved developmental to the evolution of the Israelite theology, because it was closely influenced by the environment that surrounded these people and within which they evolved. And as the evidence will continue to show, folks, this distinctive notion of household family model, likely derived from the deification of Abraham's Lord and his wife Sarah. But for the time being, Let's have a closer look at the features and attributes of the key deities of this Ugaritic pantheon. Now, most scholars accept the idea that the name El derives from the Akkadian Il and Ilu. And the term El is basically, it's a generic Hebraic term that just means God. Much like Elohim, it's a generic term meaning gods in the plural sense. And in the Ugaritic literature, El or Ilu refers to the supreme God of Canaan, much like Elohim refers to Yahweh in the Hebrew Bible. But folks, the fact that the Abrahamic narrative in Genesis makes no reference to Baal or Asherah supports the idea that Abraham had no idea who these deities were yet. And as the scholar Lewis points out, he didn't know about Yahweh either. Abraham only knew about El. Quoting Lewis here, it is often argued that the absence of Yahweh in this name, together with the name of the Shechemite deity El, the god of the patriarch Israel in Genesis 33:20, and the absence of Yahweh and Baal in anthroponyms and toponyms in early literature, indicate the antiquity of El worship over Yahweh worship. Now, El is not only the oldest deity of Canaan, but he is also the most important one as well. And as it predates the concept of the divine council, we should not be surprised to find El presiding over the assembly and deciding fates and dispensing divine justice over all the other gods of the world who are known to these authors at the time, that is. But Lewis notes that many scholars have argued that El had a long Semitic pedigree dating back to the pre-Sargonic period, and was especially popular during the Amorite period of the 18th century BCE. Folks, that is half a millennia before we start getting the Israelite stories. Then Francesca Stavra-Kapalu. She also notes that El was worshipped long before Yahweh in the Hebrew Bible. And she quotes, "Scholars have long suspected that El, not Yahweh, was the original God of the people known in the Bible as Israel. His name not only occurs in the traditions of the patriarchs, but is embedded in the name of Israel itself, Yisrael, and is explicitly revealed in the divine name of a temple Jacob is said to have built at the ancient city Shechem, in what is now located in the West Bank. He erected an altar there and called it El, God of Israel." Now this statement, coupled with the fact that the Jewish tradition places the patriarchal period to the 18th century BCE, suggests that the god El was the only god worshipped by the patriarchs. Because the absence of any reference to Baal and Asherah in the Abrahamic narratives likely testifies to the effect that their cult had not yet been established. And as we will discuss later, this is a critical observation to us in this investigation of this podcast. Also found in Ugaritic literature is the goddess Atharat, or better yet, Asherah in the Bible, or Sarah, Abraham's wife. As she appears as El's consort, as Baal's sister, she is also occasionally presented as Baal's consort in some inscriptions. But Asherah is the goddess of fertility, associated throughout the Near East with Atharat, Ishtar, Anat, Astarte, and Baalat, or Zapernit. It is only recently that Dever and Hadley showed that Asherah eventually also became regarded as Yahweh's consort as well. We also have the Kuntilet Ajrud Pithos, which is the famous storage jar inscription that speaks of Yahweh of Shamran, which is Samaria, and his Asherah. And then there's the one carved into the wall of the Kirbit El-Qam tomb, where someone is blessed by Yahweh and by his Asherah. And they are dated similar to the 8th century BCE, and they continue to stir controversy among scholars. However, scholars just cannot agree on the description of the pictures, or if one should see the word Asherah, the goddess deity, or the Asherah as in the cultic symbol. For Jen Glay Taylor, the answer lies in the previously discussed Tanakh cult stand that we talked about of the late 9th century BCE, on which one can find two representations of the goddess flanked by two lions. Remember that? One, Asherah is depicted as the naked goddess herself, and the other as a tree of life. For Taylor, there is little doubt that Asherah was perceived as both a consort to Yahweh, as well as an object of cultic practice. Now, once you are aware of this relationship that took place between Yahweh and Asherah, now, it's difficult to read this 8th century BCE prophet Hosea and not see his little tirade and explicit condemnation of the cult dedicated to Asherah, the consort of Yahweh and the mother goddess of Israel. And I'll read it. Hosea chapter 2, verse 2. Plead with your mother. Plead, for she is not my wife, neither am I her husband, and let her put away her whoredoms from her face, and her adulteries from between her breasts. Hosea chapter 2, verse 11. And I will cause her mirth to cease, her feasts, her new moons, and her Sabbaths, and all her solemnities. Hosea 2, 12. And I will make her desolate, her vine and her fig tree, whereof she hath said, these are my rewards, which my lovers have given me, and I will make them a forest, and the beast of the field shall eat them. And then Hosea 2:13. And I will visit upon her the days of the balls, wherein she burned incense to them, and decked herself with rings and jewels, and went after her lovers, and forgot about me, saith Yahweh. Oh, that's just really sad. And then 2 centuries later, the Israelite authors continued to show their devotion and attachment to Asherah, their queen of heaven. Jeremiah 44:16 through 18 reads, as for the word thou hast spoken unto us in the name of the Lord, we will not hearken unto thee, but we will certainly do whatsoever thing goeth forth out of our own mouth, to burn incense unto the queen of heaven, and to pour out drink offerings unto her. As we have done, we and our fathers, our kings, and our princess, in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem. For then had we plenty of victuals, and were well, and saw no evil. But since we left off to burn incense to the Queen of Heaven, and to pour our drink offerings unto her, we have wanted all things, and have been consumed by the sword and by the famine. Now, just in these few verses that we read, they support the idea that Asherah had indeed become Yahweh's consort in the eyes of the early Israelite authors, poets, and storytellers. It was mainstream. Because the many parallels that can be drawn between the passages in the story of Abraham and the religion practiced by the ancient Canaanites have previously been understood as influences. because we've been unable to dissociate the anthropomorphic figure from the immaterial figure in the Bible. And as such, we didn't realize that these similarities represented much more than one aspect of the patriarch's religion. And for sure, guys, when one understands that that anthropomorphic figure in the Abrahamic narrative in Genesis is a mortal overlord, a Mesopotamian king, and that the God that appears in the text only exhibits immaterial characteristics, and one realizes that this God fits perfectly in the description of the Canaanite El. Well, folks, once again, that's what we call a wrap. So we're wrapping up episode 3, beginning of season 7, because we've got a long way to go still. And I hope you're enjoying the content. I hope that you're not getting too lost within the information. Highly advise buying the books that I'm talking about. Highly advise going back and re-listening to the episodes. But the first author I want to talk about is, let's support these guys, is Mark Smith. And we're quoting him a lot, especially in this episode here. But I highly advise purchasing The Early History of God and Other Ancient Canaanite Deities. And also, he's not a new author, but he's got a handful of books out there, but he's got a great book that's coming up, and that's a lot of what we're covering right now. But his name is Bernard Lamborel. Bernard Lamborel. You can find him on Amazon. And if you pull him up right now, you'll find that the first book available is called The Covenant, on the Origin of the Abrahamic Faith by Means of Deification. Okay, you can get it on paperback for under $20. And also, and we're going to be covering this in the episode too, or in the podcast, To Be Done with Sodom, The Untold Account of War, Oppression, Sex, and Inheritance That Gave Rise to the God of Israel. That one also is on paperback, and that one's for just under $10. Then he also has a French edition of Quid Pro Quo, which is the new revised English book that's going to be coming out. We're working on it. I'm working on nudging Bernard a little bit. Come on, let's get this thing released so you guys can actually read along with it as we're doing the podcast. But ultimately, folks, you got to buy these books. I'm only giving you just the top stuff, because if you go and you start talking about it with your friends or whatever, you're going to need the supporting data. And these books is what has the supporting data. I'm just giving you a performance and giving you some great clues, some good information. So once again, thank you for listening. Thank you for following along. And guys, if you've been here since season 1, episode 1, holy shit, that very first episode was like, what, 15 minutes long? And now it's got like 30,000 downloads? Yeah, nobody's listening to my show 30,000 times, that's for damn sure. But thank you for following along. And if you've been with me for that long, that's endurance, guys. And I'm probably not going to get another episode out before Christmas, so, or Kris Kringlemas, or for Hanukkah. Guys, what's the African one? It's not coming to me, I forget. No, guys, don't hate on me. But anyway, I appreciate you all. Have a very, very Merry Christmas. Have a happy Hanukkah. Be safe out there. Take care of each other. And I will see you guys on the flip side. See you guys for episode 4. Kwanzaa, Kwanzaa, Kwanzaa. Damn it. Happy Kwanzaa, folks. Happy Kwanzaa.